Hello and welcome to Everything in Between, the podcast where a dad and daughter duo delve deep into topics ranging from true crime to paranormal occurrences to urban legends and, well, everything in between. I'm Emma.
I'm the dad.
That's Anish. And it's another Tuesday, but that's fine. In quarantine, time isn't real, so.
Again, we're just going to pretty much do hardly any edits and just upload because we don't have time. So, but, you know, yeah. It's fine. It makes it, I guess, a little easier, but yeah.
And you guys just got to deal with it, you know? Yeah. You better love it. So we came to a huge milestone recently in that I finished my fourth rewatch and my lovely father saw in almost entirety for the first time Avatar the Last Airbender.
Yes, I find, yep. I mean, I didn't really watch it straight through. I
think you missed some of the first season.
I liked it. I can understand why it's one of your favorites and why everybody loves it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, just never watch the movie and we're good. You will be disappointed. So I thought it was great. And now we have to find a way to watch Legend of Korra as well, because I don't think it's available anywhere for free.
I was trying to figure out where Nickelodeon streams. I don't know.
I think they have like a Nickelodeon app, but I don't know if.
Yeah, I just don't. I didn't. For some reason, I thought they were bought by one of the biggies, but I guess they still are their own entity. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, hopefully we can find it somewhere because it's been a while, and I don't think I actually watched all of it. So I would like to see it again.
I haven't seen any of it, so.
Well, yeah. But that's exciting. And we started watching season 2 of Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts.
We saw, how many episodes did we watch?
We watched two?
Yeah, I mean.
I think we only saw two.
Yeah, it's good. Again, I mean, the other season was great too, but this is, I mean, I think there's spoilers, but you know.
Yeah,
it's not really a spoiler. I shouldn't say that. It's the end product look is what it is.
Oh yeah. They do kind of put that in the thing, but it's still worth watching and it's very funny. And even though it's a kid's show, I think it's great.
I mean, I mean, a lot of cartoons may be for kids, but I think the majority of them are. I don't know how you want to call kid shows. I think if you want to be a real kid show, it's like Little Einsteins or, you know, The Wiggles and that kind of thing is a kid show. I think this is just a cartoon that is, if you're seven or older, you know, I think you'll get it.
You can enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think it's a kid show.
Okay. Fair. Well, that's just another reason to go watch it. But yeah, that was really fun. And then the 20th, June 20th, was the 45th anniversary of Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
And so with our whole revamped, like, sound system and...
Well, partially, because we didn't.
Yes, you revamped the other part yesterday. Plus, it was in, like, 4K. And so we just, you know, settled in, watched it. And
well,
it was,
you go ahead.
I was going to say it was just as magical. But we noticed on, I don't know what number rewatch that was, but we did notice, I think you started noticing first, that there are little some issues with the timeline.
Well, I guess it's, I don't want to ruin, because I mean, there's just little flaws that happened, but I think because we've seen it so many times, mm-hmm. then you're like, oh yeah, you know this, but the key though is that the 4K version just got released in early June, and what I didn't know was that they actually, when they remastered it for it might have been the 35th release, or maybe maybe it was the 40th, I don't even know. But they did a 4K master, but at the time, they didn't release it because they just didn't have enough, the equipment wasn't there, you know, it wasn't cost effective for people, so they were just sitting on it. So the Blu-ray actually was downscaled from the 4K, and there was nothing about sound. So when they had the ability to do the 4K, again, it's also just to make money because they could keep selling the DVD, Blu-ray, you know, digitally, whatever you want it to be. That's great and all, but the key part was that they could actually add the sound as well because they had the medium to do it. So I will say we are lucky because we bought it digitally when it was, I don't remember what version it was, but they've just upgraded automatically. So we haven't had to pay any more, which kudos to, I don't know who, but, but it is worth seeing again. And if you have a 4K, if you have the ability to watch 4K, you'll notice things, and the sound, if you have sound, I never saw it in the theater when I was five, you know, I had to wait till I was later, but I, from everything I've read, everybody says it is the closest to a theater production now than
you'll ever get. It felt like it was in the theater. Yeah. And I thought, I just realized it's kind of funny that it came out when you were five and then you showed it to me for the first time when I was five.
I'm pretty sure if my dad could have showed it to me when I was five, he would have. I think that's that would have been it. But we didn't have VHS yet or anything.
Don't worry.
Like
I'll
that.
Continue the tradition if I ever have kids. But yeah, that was really fun. And what else did we do?
Well, I mean, we didn't. It's weird because we were in Maine. We came back. It's just on an off schedule. So we haven't watched anything as near. And then you've had a couple graduation social distancing parties and things like that. So it's just been.
I had some really good cupcakes.
Yeah. So I think it's, we have to get back into the groove. But I know that, well, depending on what happens for the 4th of July week, we'll be watching a bunch starting with the thing on Disney.
Oh my God. I was like, what am I not remembering? Hamilton's coming out.
Yeah, so that's something we're debating on how to watch it because I don't think it's 4K, nor will it be Dolby Atmos. So I feel like watching
and also it's PG-13.
Who cares?
So they got rid of some of my favorites.
If that's what you're focused on, then I think you're missing the bigger picture.
Some of it is just
you should
the
be
vibe.
Psyched that they're giving it out. They're allowing it to be shown because everything that's going on and it has to be. Well, I mean, I know it's not Lin-Manuel Miranda because I think he was a surprise as anyone that they were moving it up as quickly because it was going to be only in theaters. But just you should be happy and stop complaining about anything else and just watch it because
I am happy, but I'm also sad.
But yeah, so it's just a matter of where we see it. So I think that's good. We may even try to do like our own little outdoor drive-in. I don't know. We have to figure that out.
That would be really fun.
Yeah, it's just the sound that I'm worried about. So
we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if you want to geek out a little bit about your subwoofer.
Yeah. So for if folks want to just fast forward now, that's fine too. But for those who want to hear, I've had this clip subwoofer for. Oh my God, when I moved to Boston, 93. So I don't think I had it originally, maybe 95. That's how I've had it since 95. And it was phenomenal and loved it. But for at least the last 4 to 5 years, it's been sputtering. I tried everything. I tried taking apart all these other things. But so I've been talking about it for a while. But and your mom, I get it. She's not the biggest fan of bass, this, that, or whatever in watching movies because it gets too loud. So I think she was like, we don't need one. But then finally, we were watching a movie. I think we were watching Skull Island when we got the Atmos speakers. And you could hear the popping because it wasn't working. So she finally gave in. And for Father's Day, helped she let me pick it out because she was like, I'm not picking anything out, you need to figure out the right one. And we got another clip that is a reference subwoofer that connects to my Atmos ones, and we came yesterday, put it in. Honestly, I said this to Emma yesterday, I feel like I've been missing 50% of the sound after listening to this, so I cannot believe what a difference it makes. And I'm not even, you know, it's not one of those I'm putting it to 11 type things. It is really, I got to play with to get to the right level with phase and this and that, but oh my God. So I'm sorry for geeking out on all that. I know people don't care, but so back to our normal programming.
Yes, I was going to say you tested it out with like maybe 5 different movies and you would have kept going, but I had to stop you and make you go write your story for this episode.
So yeah, everyone's welcome, I guess. But
yeah.
But no, I'll probably watch some more today. I'll decide what I'm going to watch. I need to watch a full film is what I really need to do. Because we did watch the beginning of Jaws again, just in that, to feel it. And I was like, oh my God, we might have to watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Also, it was really nice to watch Wonder Woman with the new system.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm intrigued.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so I guess we can go into our stories.
No, we can't.
No? What did
the
I
Premier
forget?
League has started
my
up again.
God.
So I just want everyone to know that it started a week ago, roughly, that the season Project Restart had happened. And Liverpool played on Sunday. They were 6 points away from the title. And they had the derby. No fans. It's kind of weird. But, I mean, we watched the leagues. And they tied Everton. I don't know. I wasn't expecting much. I mean, they could have lost the game. They got a couple injuries. But so now we're 5 points away from the title, and we have a game tomorrow, but it's coming, and I can't wait for it to happen. But I will say, having soccer, football back on it's needed mentally, because it is different, but it was just amazing to watch Klopp's press conference, to watch them play, even though it's not the same, but I'll take it. Beggars can't be choosers. And then the last thing is a shout out to my brother, Bob, who you mentioned this show as well, but he's been talking about it, and he's like, you gotta watch this, it's for you. And I've seen other people, I just never got into it. So I watched 3 episodes of Letterkenny yesterday.
Oh my God. I never saw that show.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
It is.
I just remember
hysterical.
Seeing the commercials when we were watching the World Cup.
It is,
and it was so strange.
It is strange. It is. I even your mom liked it. So I'm kind of psyched. But there's one episode he keeps telling me that I will lose it. So I can't wait to get to that. But I think it's a couple seasons in. I don't know how to explain it. It's dumb humor to a point, but then it's interspersed with just these factoids of things in general, and it's the delivery is in this monotone Canadian. The guy who actually is Wayne, I believe, is the writer director of the series, creator, and it's great. So I'm happy now that I have this new show, and I have, I think, 4 seasons to watch. So
good,
that's what I'll be doing. But yeah, that's it. So now we can do our stories. Sorry about that. There we go.
Yeah, Wow.
I think there's also a cartoon I heard that there's an animation one too that they added this year. So I'm intrigued to see that this. So like I said, there are definitely some just, you know, bathroom humor throughout, but then there's these points where you're like, this is great. All right. So you're doing.
I'm doing an urban legend.
All right. I got a true crime.
Cool.
All right. Let's hear it.
Okay, so this is kind of, it's an urban legend, and I'm like sort of telling it in a different way. I guess, I don't know how to really explain it, but I'm telling it like it's a story instead of like, you know, facts, kind of. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, because you always have to, you have to give background color.
Give
you have
it
to,
like
you
blood
ha- otherwise,
and flesh and,
it's just, oh, somebody saw this. This was its occurrence. This is what happened. And there's no way to connect it all together.
Yeah.
So you
without
have to,
this, the story literally would have been a
no,
paragraph.
And I think that's, it's better when you basically add your touch to it. So it may, yeah, it becomes more of a real urban story versus legend kind of thing.
So my sources were Thrillist, Mental Floss, and Atlas Obscura, the Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess we can just jump into it.
Let's go.
So, somewhere in her darkened room, the clock ticked closer and closer to midnight. Her window was open halfway, and the cool breeze of night filled her curtains, transforming them into rapidly twisting shapes, dancing around the window as the bright light of the moon streamed through them. The crickets hadn't chirped for hours. Besides the whistling wind and ticking clock, the world was silent. And yet, she couldn't sleep. Something about that cool night air captivated her. Something about the light of the moon urged her to follow it outside. Hesitating, she checked her phone, lifting it from her bedside table. A text had come in about 10 minutes ago from one of her new friends, Jenna. It was pretty short, just some coordinates and the caption, "You coming?" She sighed and let her gaze drift from the phone back to the window, matching her breaths to the ticking of the clock. Her parents were asleep. They'd never know if she just took her bike and got back before dawn. Plus, if she wanted actual friends, she should prove that she wasn't a wuss or anything. Before she could convince herself otherwise, she texted a confirmation and threw back her covers, searching her bedroom floor for something reasonable to wear before tiptoeing down the stairs and gingerly opening the back door. The house alarm, which she'd already turned off, chirped as she did so, and she froze, hoping no one would wake up. The silence fell once more, and she continued on her way, retrieving her bike and pasting the coordinates into Google Maps. Then she was on her way, 100 thoughts racing through her head as she glided down the dark streets of Clifton, Virginia. So, let's switch perspectives here a little bit. A little switching up action. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know
what I'm doing. Sounds good, no? I like it.
So, Jenna had already been at the bridge for hours, and it was getting pretty boring. She was there with some of the more daring kids at school, Madison, who was always there for everything, Jacob, who had the idea to come here in the first place, and TJ, who had supplied the various tools of rebellion, beer, cigarettes, stuff like that. The topic of conversation had quickly shifted to the new girl, Delia, from Vermont. Everyone had an opinion of her already, and they were excited to have something else to talk about for once. Then something in the bushes rustled, and the group sort of stiffened. A moment passed. Nothing, so they just sort of went back to their conversation. The sad little campfire that Jacob had made flickered, casting grotesque shadows on the classmates' faces. When Madison found out that Jenna had Delia's number, she urged her to invite the new girl to their little gathering. "Odds are," she had said, "she won't know anything about this place. We could totally scare her." TJ leaned forward, a grin spreading on his face. "I have an axe in my car," he said. "It could be like a little hazing, something fun." Jacob threw some sticks on the fire, allowing it to grow a few inches momentarily before settling. He didn't contribute. Jenna shook her head, nervously picking at a hangnail on her pointer finger. "She just got here. It wouldn't be fair," she said. Madison smirked. "Come on, it'll just be a small spook. You can stay here by the fire, and the three of us will jump out of the bushes and scare her when she arrives." "You have to tell Delia the context first, Jenna. Then we'll rustle the bushes or something. That'll be your cue to say some shit like, 'Oh no, he's here,' and then we'll jump out. It'll only last a second." The three of them looked at her expectantly. Sighing, she took out her phone and started typing. "Make sure she thinks you're alone," Jacob reminded her. Jenna sent the message and tucked her phone back in her pocket. Delia. The bridge wasn't too far from her house, so Delia arrived pretty quickly. She could smell the odor of tobacco already, and she saw weak flames coming from the entrance. It didn't really look much like a bridge, she noticed. More like a tunnel, kind of. And she sort of looked around cautiously before she heard her name being called by someone near the entrance. She jumped, and her bike clattered against a tree, but soon she realized that it was Jenna, and so she approached cautiously. Jenna was sort of hanging around by the weak fire, holding a cigarette and her phone, which cast a cold light on her face as she lifted an arm to wave her over. The fire ended up being pretty warm despite its puny size, and Delia looked around, sort of unsettled. "What is this place?" she asked, waving off Jenna as she offered her a beer. "You just come here by yourself?" "Yeah," Jenna looked into the fire. "It's a bit of a thrill. You know about the story, right?" Delia shook her head, tensing as the fire sparked loudly. Jenna tossed her cigarette butt into the ground, burying it with her heel before speaking. "This," she said, is Bunny Man Bridge. I assume you know this one.
You didn't do this before?
No. You might be thinking of Goat Man. But all right. I've never done Bunny Man.
All right.
I hope not. That would be awkward.
Try to think why I know it then. Because I don't. All right.
Well, this one, Jackie actually told me about it a while ago, and I've been sitting on it for a while.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. So, long ago, in like 1904, a bus was taking this route to some prison nearby. The bus was, of course, loaded up with mental patients from an old asylum here in Clifton. And as they approached the tunnel, the driver lost control and crashed. No one was harmed, but the police on board had to round up all the patients who'd taken the opportunity to flee into the woods. They managed to get everyone back, though. Well, everyone except for one man. Some say that he caused the crash in the first place, but others think that he just wasn't really smart enough for that. He seemed to act on instincts only, and he barely spoke. When he did try to communicate, all you would hear were moans, like he was in pain. The police searched for an hour, and they couldn't find him, and so they decided they just needed to get the convicts to the prison. So they called for backup and then continued on their way. Backup arrived, and a whole team of officers swept through the woods looking for this man. But they just could not find him. The searchers kept looking for days, for weeks even, but nothing turned up. However, they did start to notice that they were finding the bodies of rabbits. All of them were skinned and half-eaten, and sort of strewn about the forest where they were looking. Eventually, they stopped searching. They focused their efforts on other cases, other causes, and the man was kind of forgotten. Years later, a couple was on a walk and came to the bridge. Before they could cross it, they heard a rustling in the bushes. They turned towards the sound and screamed in horror as a man leapt from the forest into their path. He was covered in blood and had an axe, and no one knows where he got it from. But that wasn't the worst part. His face was covered in a mask of rabbit skin with holes cut out for the eyes and nose. The couple took off running, obviously, and told their story to anyone who would listen. Another search was conducted, but they still couldn't find him. From that story, the bridge got its sort of unofficial name, Bunny Man Bridge. As years passed, there were more sightings, and Bunny Man became kind of a legend. A warning against being out at night, against coming to that bridge. The tunnel began to be frequented by teens looking for a good scare, and more stories of fear spread, making him just more iconic. Going to the bridge at night became kind of a rite of passage for local high schoolers. In the 1970s, a man was hitchhiking when he came upon the road and thought he heard something near the bridge. When he went to investigate, he recoiled in horror when he got to the bridge-slash-tunnel-y area. What he saw was a bloody, gory mess of limbs and entrails, piled sort of haphazardly by the entrance. The pile ended up being a group of five teenagers.
Oh, man.
All brutally murdered and torn apart by something or someone. The most gruesome part is that they actually couldn't put the bodies completely back together because they were kind of missing some of their organs. You know, as you do. On some of the bodies, they noticed that large swaths of skin were missing, like they were cut off. Medical examiners determined that the kids had been attacked with an axe, but their bodies also bore evidence of bite marks and rips. The hitchhiker ended up being prosecuted for their murder, even though they never found the axe and his teeth didn't actually match the marks that they found. He's still in prison, actually, waiting execution. More people have reported sightings of Bunny Man since then. They'll see him brandishing an axe and charging them, or they'll hear his chilling moans of anguish, or they'll just come across skinned rabbits near the entrance to the tunnel. But coming here at night is still a rite of passage, and he hasn't been seen in a long time, but people still like to tell the story. As Jenna finished her tale, the fire kind of crackled menacingly. Shouldn't he be dead by now? Delia asked quietly. If he was a grown man in 1904, there's no way he'd be alive. And even if he was, he'd be too old to even lift an axe, much less massacre teenagers. Jenna shrugged before picking up a beer can and taking a long drink. I don't know. Some say he's not really alive at this point. Some kind of creature, no longer human. Delia shivered involuntarily. Somewhere behind her, the bushes rustled. She whipped around, but nothing was there. Are you sure we're alone out here? Delia asked. Her voice squeaked a bit, which annoyed her. She was too old for urban legends. I only invited you, Jenna replied. But that rustling... I don't mean to alarm you. It's probably nothing, but that's usually a sign that the bunny man is near. Delia's eyes widened before she could get her expression under control. Before she could speak, the bushes rustled again, and suddenly, a shape was jumping out at her from the foliage. Taken by surprise, she fell to the ground and yelped, shutting her eyes. Then, she heard laughter. Opening her eyes again, she recognized that girl Madison from her art class, cracking up. Another voice was laughing, too. She turned and saw a kid who she knew to be named Jacob, doubled over in hysterics next to Jenna, who looked pretty uncomfortable. Delia stood up and scowled, dusting herself off. Not cool, she muttered. Madison recovered from laughing and smiled. Oh, please, she said. You're a Clifton kid now. That's a rite of passage right there. You handled it better than most. Delia let a small smile bloom on her face, but Madison's faded suddenly. She scanned the clearing, confused. Then she rolled her eyes and cupped her hands around her mouth. TJ, she called. TJ, you missed your cue. Jacob and Jenna had also stopped talking, and they were looking around as well. Oh, man, Jacob said, as Madison called for TJ again. TJ had the axe. That would have gotten you even more. He ruined it. The bushes rustled again, and the group turned toward the sound. Delia's heart leapt as a figure emerged from the foliage, but it was no creature. It was another high schooler. This must be the TJ they were talking about. He staggered into the clearing and opened his mouth, letting out a moan of anguish. The sound chilled Delia to the core, and she stepped back instinctively. Madison sighed and put her hands on her hips. Great impression, TJ, but the joke's over. You're about 2 minutes late. TJ looked at her for a second, then collapsed forward, falling face first into the road. The group recoiled as they saw his axe buried deep in his skull, blood trickling down from his hair and pooling on the ground. Madison let out a half-scream, half-retch as she ran to TJ, checking his pulse. Delia's ears were ringing. As the sound faded, she heard the bushes rustle again and a low moaning coming from the direction that TJ had stumbled out of. Someone grabbed her arm. It was Jenna, her phone in the other hand, frantically trying to dial 911. Run, she advised Delia, who tried to respond but found that her throat was too dry to make a noise. Madison cried out from the ground, and Jacob was rooted in place, his face pale and sickly. Delia started to run, and Jenna yelled into the phone about someone attacking them. She blindly felt for her bike, found it, and glanced back at the clearing. She should have just kept going. Madison was crumpled over TJ, but she wasn't moving anymore. A tall figure stood over her, and Delia's gaze rose until she saw his arms reaching up over his masked head, clutching a large axe. He swung down, and Delia forced herself to look away. She didn't know where Jenna was, she couldn't see Jacob, and she forced herself not to call out to them. She jumped on her bike and rode away as fast as she could, barely able to see the road in front of her through her tears. She didn't know the way home, so she just rode until she found a place with a streetlight and civilization nearby. From there, she texted Jenna, afraid that if she called her, she might give away her friend's location. Hopefully, she'd gotten away. Guilt fell onto Delia's chest suddenly, and she physically sagged in her seat. She felt a little bit better when she got a message back from Jenna, who confirmed that she was okay, but she hadn't heard from Jacob. She said the police were on their way to the bridge and to just go home. She said she was sorry. Delia pulled up directions back to her house and took off, riding faster than she thought she could. Only when she had locked the door and woken up her parents to cry in her arms did she truly feel like she'd escaped. A few miles away, deep in the forest, a weak fire burned, its pale glow flickering in grotesque shadows over still faces. Somewhere in the distance, sirens blared, covering the noise of moaning deep in the woods. So, my version. A lot more dramatized than what actually is this, the legend. But I figured that would be a fun little...
I like that one. That's a good campfire one. That's... I was thinking of the, just the, so is the mask, it's, I understand it's rabbit skins, but is it also a rabbit?
Well, that was just me saying it was rabbit skins. In the actual legend, he's wearing like a bunny mask. Like it just like, is a bunny head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or some people say so it's like a costume.
Like strangers, like that kind of.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, it's based on a true story of somebody breaking into homes and they would wear masks.
Lovely.
Like a bunny mask.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. I was thinking, I was imagining that scene from, Pet Cemetery kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that. Yep. 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 Yep.
But yeah, so the actual urban legend of Bunny Man is it's a real story from Clifton, Virginia, and there is a Bunny Man Bridge. And I think it's actually called like Fairfax Bridge or something, but no one calls it that. So the actual legend begins with that convict story from 1904. But it's unconfirmed if anyone's actually died from like those, the group of five teenagers, like that's, that's just part of the legend. And that part of the legend is just like, they went to the bridge on Halloween night and they were discovered dead the next morning.
I'm kind of thinking of like Trick or Treat too, like with the, the bus and everything.
That's what I was thinking when I was typing this. And so there've been a lot of reports of people, or from people like of a man wearing a bunny costume, threatening them with an axe. Some people even reported that he actually threw the axe at them. And they haven't been found. They haven't found the guy who's been doing that either.
Seems like that, like Wrinkles the Clown type thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently one of them was like this couple that was going for a drive and a guy in a bunny hat with an axe yelled at them saying they were trespassing on private property and he threw the axe at them and it hit their windshield. So that's one of the stories. So there, we don't know if there's any bunny man that's responsible for actually disemboweling teens, but they do find a lot of dead rabbits in that area and still makes a good story.
Yeah, no, legend. It does. That's a good, it's a really good campfire story.
Yeah.
Well done. Awesome.
Enjoy. Thank you.
All right. So I have a true crime. I've been struggling for the song title, so I was just changing it right now because I thought of something last night, but whatever. Well, anyway, this takes place in 2011 in Irvine, California. I'll just start and then we'll get to the sources and things like that. So it's an early morning in March of 2011. An off-duty firefighter is walking on the sidewalk in Irvine, basically, you know, approaching a house.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on his phone talking softly and he is definitely walking with a confidence, a swagger. I mean, he's, you know, it's not that he looks out of place, but he's noticeable.
Okay.
Now he is fully aware of his surroundings and he's, you know, nonchalantly kind of surveying everything as well. So he's just looking around and there's a reason for that. Now, as he appears to meet the destination or get to his destination, I should say, he's looking around a little bit more and something kind of catches his eye and he's about to turn up the walkway to the house and he just stops and he's now staring at a car. So think of it as you're coming to this house. There's a car parked on the opposite side of the road, just maybe a driveway or a driveway and a half further.
Okay.
And when he stops, he thinks, this is odd. And he basically does a 180 and just starts walking away, briskly walking away.
Oh.
You know, basically from where he came. So at that same time, when he does the 180, the front door of the house opens and a woman comes out dressed in a negligee, takes a few steps out, and then she notices this car.
Oh, my.
So my belief is that there weren't many cars on the street, but this one was there. And she abruptly re-enters the home.
Jeez.
Now, this firefighter has reached his pickup truck, okay? And it was also not parked right by the house. It was kind of off, you know, basically not to be seen kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's trying to get in the car to basically take off and speed away, he's blocked by other cars.
Okay.
He doesn't resist because he now realizes that these are cops.
Ooh.
He knows he hasn't done anything illegal, so he complies with their orders, exits the pickup. Though he had done anything, you know, illegal,
mm-hmm.
he had done something immoral.
Oh, no.
The firefighter's name was Glenn Gomez. Okay. He was a married man. And he had been having an affair for the past 2.5 years with a beautiful Swedish girl. His description.
Okay. That's so not good. Don't
as he tells the cops why he was there, you know, he starts to wonder, like, wait, why are you here?
Oh.
Now, they start talking a little bit more about where he's going, describing this woman. And, you know, he knows she's married, so mm-hmm. he's still at a loss, though, like, what's going on? So now he's thinking, well, maybe the husband has something. What's the deal? Cops are being very tight-lipped, but they basically say that, you know, look, we're about to serve a warrant to this beautiful Swedish girl. And then they tell him that, you know, you're in the middle of something that is pretty serious, and I think it could hurt you and your family.
Oh.
And then they said, but we're not going to get into all the detail. We may need your help. So let's just say that I don't think this person you're seeing is who you think she is.
Oh.
And she'll probably ruin you.
Oh.
He says, I love this woman. There's a lot more detail about their relationship and things like that. But he's listening, right?
Okay. So
police kind of basically say, we're going to take you to the station, this, that. You're not under arrest or anything like that. We just need to do some checking on Glenn himself because they don't know how he fits into anything.
Right, okay.
Because they're about to be sworn. What Glenn didn't know, and what he would soon find out, was that his Swedish lover was a combination of a reality TV housewife from, you know, Orange County,
oh.
and the fictional Gone Girl.
Oh, I have not read Gone Girl.
So,
but I think I know the premise.
Okay, well, let's put it this way. This story is, I mean, it's batshit crazy.
Okay.
But believable. And I don't know if that is more of a sad commentary on the human psyche or what, but...
On the what psyche?
The human or human. I like to say it my way, but whatever. I get crap
the wrong
from my...
way.
Yeah, fair. But anyway, but it's one of these things where you're like, oh yeah, I could have seen this in a movie. And maybe that's what these are based on that we've seen recently, but it is something. So let's sit tight. We're going to take a ride about status, reputation... And revenge. And this is all has to do with an elementary school.
Okay.
So the sources for this story are, well, I'll just say that the LA Times wrote this guy. His name is Christopher Gofford. He did a 6-part series on this whole thing, I think in 2016. It is unbelievable. It's my primary source for this thing. ABC News did a 2020 that I kind of watched. It wasn't a long one. It was maybe a 10-minute segment. And then there were follow-ups and things like that that I had read. But the majority is from this article, and I highly recommend you read. I'll talk about what the title is later because I don't want to give things away. But you should read the full detail because, oh my God. So, crime timeline.
Crime timeline.
Plaza Vista School is one of the top schools in Irvine, California.
Okay.
And Irvine, California itself, as a school district, is one of the most sought after places for parents to get have their kids receive their education. It claims 97% college acceptance. Now, it's really difficult, of course, to find housing around there because of the schools. Now, a woman, Kelly Peters, she wanted that for her daughter, and she had researched every possible property in the area to move there, and you know, and also looked at other schools. Mm-hmm. But this is what was for her. Now, Kelly, I may go between Kelly and Peters throughout. So I just okay. So just to give you a heads up, she was a California girl herself. Grew up, in the mountains, and grew up with horses, horse farm, that kind of thing.
Okay.
She was kind of a wild child, not in a bad way, just a free spirit type of person. Bohemian kind of thing, hippie type. She worked all types of odd jobs growing up, like pizzas, skating rinks, like mm-hmm. all these types of things. And then at one point, she also had this wanderlust where she just dropped everything, went to Hawaii, and then ended up staying there for like 2 years kind of thing. So she was worldly, you know, enjoyed a good time, that kind of thing. but put together.
Okay.
She was petite, 5 foot blonde, with this lust for life. Now, by the time she hit her 30s, she met her husband-to-be. And she became pregnant, I think, within, I mean, almost maybe honeymoon night. I don't know, it's exactly sure, but pretty quickly. And it changed her world immediately. She went from this, you know, wild spirit type person into this, okay, it's not about me anymore. It's about this child that I'm bringing into the world.
Okay.
She had a daughter, and she was obsessed with her daughter. You know, whatever she could give her daughter, she was going to do with that, right? So the partying, that, like, wanderlust, all that energy is now focused on her daughter. Her name was Sydney.
Okay.
Now, as her daughter was getting older and starting to approach school age, or, you know, that's when she started to research what the best schools were. Now, she also had a job. She was worked for a bank. She was a mortgage lender. And she didn't really enjoy working for the mortgage lender, but it was a professional job compared to everything else she had done. And the main reason was that it was a kind of a boys' club. There was a lot of misogyny, that kind of thing. She couldn't really handle their indifference to her clients. So it wasn't the best thing. And she decided, well, this is it. Like, it's time to find my daughter the right school. I'm quitting. I'm going to do this. And her husband was fine with that. And he also kind of did odd jobs. He didn't have, you know, the stable professional job that she did, but they understood. So that's what she ended up doing. And as she started looking around, she found Plaza Vista.
Okay.
And this was it. So the problem was they couldn't find housing. They couldn't afford housing. Or if they did find the right price point, it was gone before they could even buy it. So renting became their solution. But that also had some, you know, it wasn't a solid foundation, because if the house sold, then they could be out, that kind of thing. So, you know, everybody's trying to make a buck, this, that, whatever. So they aren't rooted. So there's some uneasiness. But her kid's in the school. Okay. And it became very clear for Kelly that she also had a knack with other kids. She started to volunteer at the school as much as possible because she had all this time. And soon she was so well known within the school, the staff, the faculty, and even the families, that they gave her a desk at the school in the front area, basically.
Wow.
So she could hear all the gossip of everything. And she said, you know, some parents would be the ones who were, you know, my son is not getting the right teacher and this is it's against me. Or, oh, or, you know, it's too sunny. Why isn't there awnings everywhere?
Oh, my God. You know, things like that.
But her main role ended up being kind of like the director for the after-school programs, the enrichment programs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good because it also helped. It was, in a way, daycare for her daughter, or more care for her daughter. But she helped a whole bunch of students. On February 16th, 2011, so we're going back in time. We were in March before, right? She was going through her daily afternoon routine. And she received a call from this karate instructor saying, hey, I'm stuck in traffic. Can you take care of the class? Just get them prep, you know, warm them up, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So she goes into the room, or she's on her way to the room, I should say, when she gets stopped. And she's told there's a policeman sitting at the front desk waiting for her.
Ooh.
She immediately thinks the worst. In her head, oh my God, my husband has been in an accident. He's dead. Like, I mean, she's thinking he's dead.
Oh God.
She runs to the policeman and is in hysterics. Like, what's wrong? Is my husband okay? This, that, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to calm her down, saying that, look, I'm not here about that. I'm here for you.
Oh God.
And she kind of stops and says, I don't understand. And he goes, well, we just got a call, 911 call, and there'd been a report of a suspicious driver under the influence. Do you own a PT Cruiser, blah, 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 with this license plate? They even mentioned your name. And she's like, yeah, I do, but I'm fine. And he's like, well, can we please take this outside? I don't want to cause a scene, this, that, or whatever. She's like, all right, yeah, sure, let's go. So then he sees the car, sees her, and he's like, well, can I search your car? She's like, yeah, sure, go ahead. So he starts to search the car, and what he ends up finding is 17 grams of weed.
Oh, my God.
A ceramic pipe.
Somebody
11 Percocet pills and 18 Vicodin. Enough to put her in jail because of prescription drugs. So the weed wouldn't have done anything, but the rest is a felony.
So someone planted that on her.
So the cop is ex-NCIS.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, armed forces, all these other things. And he's been doing this for a while, and he's a very calm person, you know, understand the situation. But of course, she immediately is like, these aren't mine. Those were planted. I don't know how they, I leave my car doors unlocked. I don't understand. And he's like, I hear that all the time. And as he's listening to her and just her demeanor, he is sensing something's not right. Okay.
Is she white?
Yes. Yes.
That explains
Irvine,
so much.
Irvine, California pretty much is all white. So now the thing that the cop is understanding is that, well, when he looked to find the drugs, they were basically in the back seat pouch, mm-hmm. like sticking out. And he's like, that's just weird in itself. So he's like, yeah, you know, it seems like they were placed to be found. So I'm listening to her story and I'm starting to believe it. But she's now almost hyperventilating because she's just thinking about everything about she's going to lose all this stuff. So she keeps pleading that these aren't mine, you know. So he goes, okay, wait. I understand where you're coming from. Just calm down. I just need you to run through some tests. So he starts doing some sobriety tests. I think 6 or 7 of them. She passes them fine. So then he starts to explain the call and says, here's the timeline, everything else. And right away, she's like, whoa. You got the call when? And it was something like 1:15. He's like, I've been here since 12:45. Like, you can go talk to whoever. So they go in and now, you know, there's some uneasiness with the administration and everything like that, but
right.
They're like, no, she's been here since that time. So he's like, okay, well, this doesn't line up. So he thinks to himself, he goes, I'm not going to handcuff you or do anything else that, but I'd like to go search your home if that's okay. And she lived very close to the school.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, absolutely. They get in the car. Like she gets in her car. He gets in his, they go to her house and they search the home. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, look, if she's into prescription drugs, there's going to be something. Nothing. The house is just like a normal house. And now he's kind of thinking, yeah, this doesn't make sense.
Right.
So as they're going through everything else, he's like, okay, look, I need to take DNA samples from you because if we find DNA on the evidence, then you could be charged later. And she's like, fine, do what you got. Do what you want. And he goes, you can take DNA from my husband. By this time, her husband had shown up too, and
mm-hmm.
they do all the testing, or they take the DNA swabs. So that's going on, and as he's going through all this, he goes like, look, again, we're not going to arrest you or anything like that, but you're not, just don't go anywhere. And okay. Then the last thing he says to her is like, well, do you you said this could be planted. Do you have any idea or anybody that may have done this? And she just stops. She goes, I have an enemy. Almost a year to the day earlier,
mm-hmm.
okay, Kelly was working the same after-school program. And she was ushering the tennis class participants to come back for pickup, right? So she's grabbing everybody. And one of the participants had been left behind and was locked outside.
Okay.
The tennis instructor actually finds this boy, it's a boy, and then brings him into the parent pickup station area. Mm-hmm. There, Jill Easter is waiting for her son and notices that he's slightly upset.
Oh no.
She then asks what happened, and Kelly explained that, well, he's usually slow to the line. It's, you know, it happens. And she didn't realize he wasn't there when she grabbed everyone. So the, you know, tennis instructor brought him back.
Mm-hmm.
Easter goes ballistic.
Oh God.
First accusing the tennis instructor of, you know, basically being a pedophile. Like, oh, why did you need to be alone with my son? This and that. And then she takes her ire onto Peters. So angry that she called her son slow that she immediately wanted her fired.
Oh my God.
It would then escalate. Easter would start lobbying parents about what happened, telling them like, look, this, you know, this woman. And now everybody knows this woman, of course, Kelly, but all this is going on.
God.
At the same time, Kelly is running for president for the PTA, mm-hmm. right? So she's, you know, trying to, you know, win this position. Jill also wanted that completely squashed to the point where she starts harassing the parents even more about Peters. The administration's like, look, this isn't how it works here. We have civility. And she's like, you can't do anything about me. I'm a lawyer. What are you going to do?
Oh my God. I hate this woman.
And
so
she
much.
Starts saying, like, I think I'm going to get stickers and shirts made up and buttons to say about talking about how Kelly Peters leaves kids alone, demeans young children, this, that, and everything else.
Oh my
Then she contacts Irvine police to investigate what happened to her son.
Oh my God.
They think it's a foolish
She's
thing.
She's the epitome of a Karen.
Jill then tries to file a restraining order to get against Kelly so that wouldn't allow her to be in the school.
Oh my God. Right?
Gets thrown out. She then decides to file a civil lawsuit against Peter, saying that she has caused irreparable psychological damage to her son's psyche.
Oh, my right? God.
And I told you.
You'd think she'd be able to take a hint after all of this failing.
Right. Now, I did mention, right, she was a lawyer. She went to a pretty decent school, this and that, did well. Her parents were, like, a father was an astrophysicist, her mom was something else.
Of course.
And I say, she's married. Her husband, Kent, also a lawyer. Now, this case would soon be dropped because the school then implemented this check-in procedure so that no kid would ever be left behind. Like, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you know, just typical things.
Right.
And things started to settle down. And after that, Peter, Kelly, thought this is all behind her. However, she did have one last interaction with Jill, which she relayed to the relayed this to the police.
Mm-hmm.
She said they were just picking something up. She was getting her son. They didn't. They kind of avoided each other. But at this one moment, Jill just looked at her in deadpan eyes, no emotion, and just said, "I'll get you."
Jesus.
So. This has all happened now after this planting of drugs. So after hearing the story, the police are kind of hesitant to, like, do anything to the Easters because they're like, all right, look, this would not be a cause of anything, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty wealthy socialites. Kent himself was an up-and-coming lawyer at this pretty big firm in the area. I don't think it was exactly Nervine. It was in Newport Beach. But he was good, and he was known and this and that. Now, Peters then also said, well, it could be another person that could be involved in this. And she explained about that there was this person who kind of lived across from the school. He was kind of eccentric. I don't want to say he was homeless, but he was an odd dude. And she kind of felt sorry for him and was very friendly with him and all these other things, where other parents were trying to avoid him and just trying to figure out how to get him away from the school.
Hmm.
And at some point, this guy decided, like, I'm going to run for PTA too. And starts then kind of harassing Jill, asking about her platforms, things like that, like really getting into it because he's going to run against her.
Right.
And then he even started saying, like, I need to see every document, all the documentation about the rules, the bylaw, how this all works and all that stuff. And she thought, well, maybe he knew that if she had drugs, that would be a disqualification, something like that, because they didn't really know much about him. And the police were like, this sounds much more plausible than two lawyers doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to interview him, look him, find out, and they rule him out almost immediately. Mainly because they're like,
be the ones that know, like, what causes the felony and everything.
Right. They're like, this guy's not smart enough to even do half the things, you know. And he wasn't even really running. He was just being crazy. So then they're like, okay, well, let's go back to the 911 call. And they start listening to the 911 call. And the 911 call starts off as this guy saying, and you can actually listen to it in this article,
mm-hmm.
about, hey, I just want to say that I just saw this person driving suspiciously. She just parked into the school. I think I know her because of, you know, my kid goes to this school. I believe it's this.
Mm-hmm.
And as the conversation starts going, they ask him to say his name. And he's like, oh, it's, I can't remember. It's like, it's an Indian name, something Chandrasekhar. Right. And he starts could you spell that? And as he starts going further and saying it, his accent becomes more Indian as he's doing it.
Oh, my God.
So they're listening to this and they're like, all right, well, that sounds odd. And they, you know, there's no Chandrasekhar at the school. There's hardly any people of color at the school in general.
Yeah,
but whatever. They go through all that and they're like, well, let's trace the 911 call. So they trace it to a hotel in Newport Beach. So they decide then to look at all the video footage for that time frame when the call went in, before, previous, and after. And as they do, they notice this, and they notice this one person, and they basically bring that video and they show it to the school administrator, saying, like, does this person look familiar to you or anything like that? And they're like, that looks like Kent Easter.
Yep. Yep.
So, of course, the police then are like, all right, let's dig in here. And they're smart in this case. What they end up doing, because they know they're lawyers and all this stuff, they're doing everything very quiet because they don't want to put anything in the public record and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They start surveilling both of them for a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then they start looking up, subpoenaing their cell phone records. And as they do, they find out that, hey, interesting, there was 15 texts between the two of them the early morning of the drug bust, or whatever you want to call
right.
it. And one of the phones, when they pinged the cell tower, was at the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, okay, well, now they got more surveillance from the courts and warrants and things like that. As this is going on, they've gathered DNA on the Easters. So they must have been, you know, tracking them and happened. And they find that that their DNA is on the drugs. I think some of it was Jill's were on some, Kent's were on all of it. Okay. So now they're ready to serve warrants, but they want to surprise them just because, again, they're lawyers and they don't want to give them any leeway or this or a heads up or anything. Plus, Kent's job, like they had to do it at his home, hit her at Kent's job. She wasn't working at the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot to say. She had written a book under the pseudonym of Ava Bjork.
Okay.
And it was called Hidden Homes or something. And it was all about completing the perfect crime.
And it was about... Oh, my God. If you're going to commit a crime, do not write a book about it.
And it was about a woman who had this with this guy, then the guy turns on her, and then she frames him and all these other things, okay?
Oh, my God.
So they realize that. They have this book now, and they're reading this book. They have this DNA. They're worried about, you know, that they're not idiots, so they're trying to figure out how to do all this. So as they're getting ready to do the warrants early in the morning, they've run into Glenn Gomez.
Mm.
Now, little did he know that what his Swedish beauty was up to. And after he did, he agreed later that he would wear a wire to follow up to meet with her. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they serve the warrant, you know, I'll get into that. So anyway, when he did do this after the fact, he got into this conversation with Jill, saying like, he's like, look, I don't know what's going on. The police are calling me. Like, is there something that are you in trouble? And she's like, yeah, I'm in trouble and I need my knight in shining armor. You know, you're my knight, this kind of,
God.
And she didn't let on into anything though. Like didn't admit to anything. And the more and more he starts hearing, she's getting a little bit more, she's bullying, more demanding, more dominant. So he breaks up with her, which was like the biggest mistake, because she goes psycho while he breaks up with her. Now remember, she's married.
Yeah.
She then proceeds to write letters to, as portraying as a friend of Jill's, to Gomez's wife, explaining everything, and then sends images, texts, photos of everything. So she orchestrated the whole thing as if it was a friend trying to let her know and this, that kind of thing.
Oh my God.
And then she starts threatening him more about not standing up for her, not being there for her, and all these other things. So, of course, all of this is recorded, the fighting, this, that, and everything mm-hmm. else. When they serve Jill the warrant, remember, she was in a negligee, went back into the house. She just kind of played dumb. And somehow, again, I don't even know how this was supposed to go down, but she has kids. So now she's with her children when she was going to have this affair. And disgusting. She let them search the house. And she was completely stoic, but the police all reported that it was stoic in a different way. Not stoic of, like, I have nothing to hide. Stoic as if I'm an actress playing a role in a movie of myself.
Ooh.
So even that was kind of weird, right? So that all goes down, and they take a whole bunch of evidence. You know, take phones, computers, this, that. Kent now was actually not at work when he was approached, and the officers try to play dumb. They're just kind of like, oh, you know, we're just investigating this thing that happened at your school. Do you know Kelly Peters? He's like, no, I don't really go to school that much and this, that, whatever. So he's just kind of listening to it. And then they start talking some more. And there's this one guy who's goes a little bit more deeper, saying, yeah, so we're thinking about this. Did you hear about that? You know, do you know anybody who may sell drugs? And he's like, and you wouldn't know anything about that. And, you know, kind of leading him on. And now he's starting to, like, change his posture, like, now folds his arms. He's wondering what's going on. And then the guy starts being kind of condescending. It's like, so, you know, a big boy would think what he's about to say and really listen to what's being told before he answers. And then he goes, you know, because, you know, a big boy would probably want to know if they've been followed or were under surveillance, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden.
Oh, my God.
So let me ask you this again. Do you know anything, blah, blah, about this? And he goes, I'd like to talk to my lawyer. And and the cop goes, that's a big boy answer.
Oh, so, my God. So don't say that.
So now the lawyers are getting involved, okay? So the case ends up sitting in limbo for almost a year. All right. So they have served the warrants, confiscating all this equipment. And what ends up happening is that it's Kent's firm who starts filing all these legal documents saying that that phone is ours. There's client, attorney, privilege information on there. You can't look at that. And guess what? You know, that she's a lawyer too. Even though she doesn't practice, she's a lawyer. She does pro bono work. There's client. So they're trying to use this wall of their attorneys. They can get away with certain things, right? That kind of stuff. So Kent then starts coming up with this scheme of how they're going to fight the case. He basically is trying to get them to be tried separately. Now, he hired this incredible lawyer to help him. And what they were basically trying to figure out was that they were both getting, I think the charge was fraud and false imprisonment or something like that, that they were being accused of. And he was trying to get Jill to go by herself and get accused first, and that she could give out certain information, maybe take the heat. But the case was so weak because they only had mm-hmm. certain things that she probably would get acquitted. And then when he was tried, she would then come in and say, yeah, she had done it, but she'd already have immunity because she's
acquitted.
Right. So they're trying to play this chess game and everything like that. And as they bring the case forward to the judge to say that this is what they want to do, the judge is like, no, you're going to be tried together.
Yes.
So during this time, like it had been a year, the original prosecutor had been gone who didn't want to press the full charges. It was this other prosecutor that came on that said, yeah. And he could have just had them plead to misdemeanors and just be done with this.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, these elitist pricks,
yes.
we're going to get them. That's
yes.
that's his whole point, right?
Eat the rich.
Yeah. So since that doesn't work, they're now saying, okay, we're going to have to be tried together. They're now figuring out their calculus as well of how they can get out of this. Since Jill wasn't practicing law, she didn't care about losing her license. But Kent was the breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
So if he lost his job, then that would be a big, big issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, he's still kind of working when this is happening. He actually became a partner when all this stuff was going down.
Oh my God.
And then finally, they did issue full arrest warrants to take him to trial. And then his firm fired him on the spot.
Good.
So he was done. And now became this crazy issue where, how is this going to work? So that's why Jill then says, okay, I would like to plead guilty to the felony count of, you know, false imprisonment of by fraud or deceit, just so she could be off the table, deal with what was going on, and then Kent would fight his his deal. And she was basically saying that, you know, it was him, right? That kind of thing. Now, what's interesting is that there was a sealed document from the original plan that they were going to do that they couldn't bring into evidence, saying that, you know, she was the one who did it and this and that, but they couldn't use it.
Right.
So she would lose her license and serve 120 days plus 100 hours of community service, okay, for this.
Are you kidding me?
Well, again, you'll see. I don't know if it was the maximum, and she ended up serving like half the time, this, that, whatever. So Kent couldn't plead guilty because then he would lose his license and all these other things, so he's going to go to trial. So his defense was, I'm a pawn in this Gone Girl-esque thing where the woman, my wife is just a dominatrix type of person and bullies me. And I, you know, I knew about the affairs, this, that, and everything, but I just couldn't get out. And I was a breadwinner. I didn't want to lose my children, you know, all these other things. Now, granted, they're still married through this whole period of time and all that stuff. And she's saying that he did it, you know, and he's saying, no, she did it, right? I was asleep that night. Oh, this is what happened. I mean, I can't believe, but this is what happened. See, that evening, she took my phone, because his phone's the one that pinged there, and because hers wasn't charged, so she left her phone here, and I guess she was going out on a tryst or something, like, you know, whatever. So they're, this is his thing, saying that it wasn't me, sleeping at home, she had my phone, and of course, the prosecutor's, like, putting holes on there, like, so, you know, she didn't expect a call from work, and let me get this straight, you guys are still living together, so you're talking about this over dinner about taking phones and, you know, the affair and this and that, you know, putting holes through it all.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecutor is like thinking, bang, 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 we got this. So it goes to the verdict. Hung jury.
How?
11 guilty. And this one woman felt sorry for Kent, thinking that, you know, yeah, he was in an abusive relationship.
No.
prosecutor's like, retrial. We're not stopping.
Okay.
We're going. Now, remember, at this point, he's losing a lot of money because he doesn't have a job. So they're all about, let's just get this done. Nope. Not taking any. We're going to trial. So, again, it was that whole elitist feel of them getting away with it that he couldn't stand, the prosecutor couldn't stand. So during this next place, they're going through everything again. They're Kelly Peters actually had testified all sort of stuff. And during the whole trial, they were waiting for Jill to come up and to have this whole big thing come up. So they were ready and they wanted that to happen. One thing that did happen, though, was the prosecutor looked through the evidence again and looked through the phone evidence again, where he found something. And I'm going to get to that point. But before that happened, Jill decided that she was going to testify here. But when she decides to testify, she says, oh, I've lost my hearing. So I would like to have a video showing me, you know, with closed captions with the questions so I can read them. And then I can, you know, answer the questions.
What?
And it was all a ploy because they knew that if they did that, they would have to transcribe it. She'd have time to look at the answer. She could hear the question, read the question, and then have her answers ready to go. And the judge is like, sorry, you don't get that. You're going to have an interpreter like everyone else does. So if you need to wear headphones, it's not. And then, of course, she decides, I'm not going to testify.
Oh, my
so
God.
That happens. So they do the whole thing, break the same thing. It was her. She took my phone, blah, blah, blah. They do the whole thing. During the closing argument, the prosecutor drops this bomb. He basically says, oh, yeah, well, you know, we pinged the tower and, you know, we found the BlackBerry was there. And we pinged this other thing that there was a text going on that was coming from the house. What we didn't tell you, and which is in the evidence of these phone records that have been submitted, is that carriers also do data checks on phones every once in a while to just see the health of the phone. And in the health checks, both phones were at the house of Kelly Peters. So that means they are both there, which means that one was a lookout, one was actually planting the drugs, and they had a babysitter that was watching the kids.
Yes.
The defense goes ballistic because they had closed their case. This was said during the closing arguments.
I thought you weren't allowed to introduce new evidence.
It was the evidence was there. Like they had submitted the records. The records were there. The evidence, they could read it. And he's just saying, and I just want to point out that when you look at the records, and the defense is like, this is bull, blah, blah, blah. And then the prosecutor basically says, well, I don't know why you're arguing. We all have the same evidence. And he finished with saying that either the defense hadn't looked at the records or the defense didn't think I looked at the records. Verdict comes back, guilty.
Thank God.
So he ends up serving years in prison and he gets kind of like beaten up a couple times. But he's released. I think he only spends half the time. I don't remember what the overall record was, or overall sentence was. And then a community service and everything like that. But he also had 3 years probation. But didn't end there. Kelly Peters files a civil lawsuit against them. And she, I didn't get into details of her, but she was like a wreck after. Like she was a shell of herself because all these things were going on and she was afraid to walk. She didn't know if they were going to come after her and all these other things. So she and her daughter was also suffering. Like she actually had to get a therapist, and which even caused more problems because it was a therapist at school. So it was really trying for her. So they start, you know, going after Kent for it because Jill doesn't have any money and all these other things. And what ended up happening was right before the first trial, they transferred their home, which was like a multi-million dollar home, into Jill's father. And then by this time they had divorced, but then they went after Jill's father too, because what did he know? What didn't he know? Like this all was a scam. Well, in the end, he loses a civil case, $5.7
million. Oh, my
God. But again, he's a lawyer.
Right.
So it's still an appeal. And they've been going back and forth. And he's saying that this is completely not justified. There was no one harmed, injured. Like the police never arrested her. All these things didn't happen and everything else. But it still stands today. He still can't practice law. And the way it works is that he could actually try to get his license again after his probation, and then 5 years later. So they're like, look, we can wait when you decide how you're going to get your money. But there's a house there that you could sell. And that would get half of that or whatever.
Nice.
And Jill Easter has now changed her name to Ava Everhart. I don't know if she's read any books, but she's actually been on TV. She was on like on a Dr. Phil or something after this all went down. No remorse. Doesn't know. Started blaming Kelly Peters for most of the issues and all these other things. So she is the some of these movies you see of like the crazy folks. It has to be based on her.
She's insane.
But Kent is just as bad. Like they really were this couple that were, we can get away with it. But that's the case of the PTA mom who was framed. And
eat the rich.
So yeah,
eat
so them. There you go. That's the story.
Oh my God.
All right. Fun facts.
Yeah. All right. So I have some rabbit themed fun facts.
Woo.
And they're a lot cuter than my story. Yeah. So
that's good.
These are all for Mental Floss. So number one, if you spend enough time around rabbits, you may be lucky enough to witness one of the cutest behaviors in nature. A bunny will hop when it's happy and do a twist in midair. This adorable action has an equally adorable name. It's called a binky. So I've never seen that, but I think it would be very cute.
I think I've seen it on nature shows.
Oh, well, sorry.
I think you have too. You just, you know.
Don't remember.
You just don't care.
Hey, anyway, number two, rabbits cannot vomit. The rabbit digestive system is physically incapable of moving in reverse. Instead of producing hairballs, rabbits deal with swallowed fur by eating plenty of roughage that pushes it down through their digestive tract.
And then, or they just choke?
I guess.
Okay.
Yikes. Number three, it's hard to sneak up on a rabbit. Their vision covers nearly 360 degrees, which allows them to see what's coming from behind them, above them, and from the sides without turning their heads. The trade-off is that rabbits have a very small blind spot directly in front of their faces.
Oh my God.
So, those are from Mental Floss. Fun facts about rabbits.
There you go.
So, my document's loading. Thing number one, we're going to link this in the description again, but still, donate, sign petitions, and do what you can to help the Black Lives Matter protest. It's not a moment. It's a movement. Keep it up.
I think the word is endurance. That's what you have to.
Yeah. Keep it in like your mind. Keep fighting every day. Don't forget it. Like, you know.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And if you safely can, please go to protests as well. So yeah, that'll be in our description for like things you can do for that. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you want to submit your own fun facts and story suggestions or your own stories that you've heard, please send them to our Gmail, which is everythinginpodcast@gmail.com. And you can also submit those to our website, which is everythingpodcast.weebly.com. So check those out. Very fun. We are on social media. Our Instagram is @everythinginpodcast. Our Twitter is @between_podcast. And we have a Facebook group and page, both by the name of Everything in Between Podcast. Also, we are now on, or I'm on Good Pods now. That's sort of like, we talked about it before, but it's sort of like sharing what podcasts you like with other people. So if you want to check us out there, my username is @EMJD. Just check it out. I don't know. It's a really cool app. And yeah. Also, if you are listening on a platform that allows you to do so, please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe. It helps us sort of get the word out there about our podcast and that kind of thing. And lastly, each week we pick songs to represent our episodes that we compile into a Spotify playlist called The Soundtrack In Between. So check that out if you want. It's a good mix. Fun to listen to. And yeah, I think that's it, right?
Yeah. No, I think, well, I don't know if I said that the last minute, but I think this is going to be winding down, right? Because you're going to college soon.
We're
so
we're probably going to go on hiatus. I'm probably going to hiatus for now.
No, we can have special edition ones that we'll go through, but I think you have some ideas for your own. So I think you should start thinking about, you know, how you're going to, you should at least let people know what you're going to plan to do. So,
yeah, I was thinking, so as you all know, I'm going to Wesleyan, and I was thinking of starting a podcast there where I just, you know, interview my fellow students about their own like paranormal or true crime or, urban legend experiences. So it's like this podcast, but first person, you know?
Yeah, no, but I think it's kind of cool to see that. So yeah, well, maybe we'll have these special releases kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe we can release a trailer for this other podcast on
here. Yeah, maybe. And I think the next week, if we do this right, we can actually do this on your birthday. So
My birthday's on a
Monday. But if we actually, you know,
if we record on a Monday,
we could get back to recording on a Monday, so I don't have to edit like crazy. But anyway, so
I thought you said this was going to be raw.
Yeah, it is going to be raw. It has to be, but it's still, I still have to do some editing. So, but anyway, so yeah, so we just want to throw that out there. And so it's the next chapter is what we'll see, but we'll have a few more still. I mean, we're not done yet. I think we're still waiting to hear when you're officially going to.
I think I'm moving in like the second to last week of August.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's what we're waiting for, the official.
Yeah, so you guys are going to get like, we're probably not going to get to 100 episodes.
We're not, but.
That's so sad.
That's all right.
Oh, this is episode 90, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Oh, man.
So all right. So till next week.
Yeah,
your birthday week.
My birthday week.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be 18.
Legal. Yeah,
out I of can the go house. To big girl prison.
Yeah, right. All right. So till next week then.
Bye.
Bye.